against his cheek reminded him of the floor of the dojo where he'd practiced sword techniques in winter. This nearly perfect instrument of both art and death reawakened in him the fighting spirit he had inherited from his father. Takezo had loved his mother, but she had left his father and moved away when he was still small, leaving him alone with Munisai, a martinet who wouldn't have known how to spoil a child in the unlikely event that he had wanted to. In his father's presence, the boy had always felt awkward and frightened, never really at ease. When he was 9 years old, he'd so craved a kind word from his mother that he had run away from home and gone all the way to Harima Province, where she was living. Takezo never learned why his mother and father had separated, and at that age, an explanation might not have helped much. She had married another samurai, by whom she had one more child. Once the little runaway had reached Harima, he wasted no time in locating his mother. On that occasion, she took him to a wooded area behind the local shrine so they wouldn't be seen, and there, with tear-filled eyes, hugged him tightly and tried to explain why he had to go back to his father. Takezo never forgot the scene. Every detail of it remained vividly in his mind as long as he lived. Of course, Munisai, being the samurai he was, had sent people to retrieve his son the moment he learned of his disappearance. It was obvious where the child had gone. Takezo was returned to Miyamoto like a bundle of firewood, strapped on the back of an unsaddled horse. Munisai, by way of greeting, had called him an insolent brat, and in a state of rage verging on hysteria, caned him until he could cane no more. Takezo remembered more explicitly than anything else the venom with which his father had spat out his ultimatum. "If you go to your mother one more time, I'll disown you." Not long after this incident, Takezo learned that his mother had fallen ill and died. Her death had the effect of transforming him from a quiet, gloomy child into the village bully. Even Munisai was intimidated eventually. When he took a truncheon to the boy, the latter countered with a wooden staff. The only one who ever stood up to him was Matahachi, also the son of a samurai. The other children all did Takezo's bidding. By the time he was 12 or 13, he was almost as tall as an adult. One year, a wandering swordsman named Arima Kihei put up a gold-emblazoned banner and offered to take on challengers from the village. Takezo killed him effortlessly, eliciting praise for his valor from the villagers. Their high opinion of him, however, was short-lived, since as he grew older, he became increasingly unmanageable and brutal. Many thought him sadistic, and soon, whenever he appeared on the scene, people gave him a very wide berth. His attitude toward them grew to reflect their coldness. When his father, as harsh and unrelenting as ever, finally died, the cruel streak in Takezo widened even more. If it had not been for his older sister, Ogin, Takezo would probably have gotten himself into something far over his head and been driven out of the village by an angry mob. Fortunately, he loved his sister and, powerless before her tears, usually did whatever she asked. Going off to war with Matahachi was a turning point for Takezo. It indicated that somehow he wanted to take his place in society alongside other men. The defeat at Sekigahara had abruptly curtailed such hopes, and he found himself once again plunged into the dark reality from which he thought he had escaped. Still, he was a youth blessed with the sublime light-heartedness that flourishes only in an age of strife. When he slept, his face became as placid as an infant's, completely untroubled by thoughts of the morrow. He had his share of dreams, asleep or awake, but he suffered few real disappointments. Having so little to begin with, he had little to lose, and although he was, in a sense, uprooted, he was also unfettered by shackles. Breathing deeply and steadily, holding on to his wooden sword tightly, Takezo at this moment may well have been dreaming, a faint smile on his lips as visions of his gentle sister and his peaceful hometown cascaded like a mountain waterfall before his closed, heavily lashed eyes. Oko, carrying a lamp, slipped into his room.
"What a peaceful face," she marveled under her breath.
She reached out and lightly touched his lips with her fingers. Then she blew out the lamp and lay down beside him. Curling up cat-like, she inched closer and closer to his body, her whitened face and colorful nightgown, really too youthful for her, hidden by the darkness. The only sound that could be heard was that of dewdrops dripping onto the windowsill.
"I wonder if he's still a virgin,"
she mused as she reached out to remove his wooden sword. The instant she touched it, Takezo was on his feet and shouting, "Thief! Thief!" Oko was thrown over onto the lamp, which cut into her shoulder and chest. Takezo was wrenching her arm without mercy. She screamed out in pain. Astonished, he released her.
"Oh, it's you. I thought it was a thief."
"Oh," moaned Oko.
"That hurt."
"I'm sorry. I didn't know it was you."
"You don't know your own strength. You almost tore my arm off."
"I said I was sorry. What are you doing here anyway?" Ignoring his innocent query, she quickly recovered from her arm injury and tried to coil the same limb around his neck, cooing,
"You don't have to apologize, Takezo."
She ran the back of her hand softly against his cheek.
"Hey, what are you doing? Are you crazy?"
he shouted, shrinking away from her touch.
"Don't make so much noise, you idiot. You know how I feel about you."
She went on trying to fondle him, with him swatting at her like a man attacked by a swarm of bees.
"Yes, and I'm very grateful. Neither of us will ever forget how kind you've been, taking us in and all."
"I don't mean that, Takezo.
I'm talking about my woman's feelings, the lovely, warm feeling I have for you."
"Wait a minute," he said, jumping up. "I'll light the lamp."
"Oh, how can you be so cruel?"
she whimpered, moving to embrace him again.
"Don't do that," he cried indignantly. "Stop it! I mean it!"
Something in his voice, something intense and resolute, frightened Oko into halting her attack. Takezo felt his bones wobbling, his teeth rattling. Never had he encountered such a formidable adversary. Not even when he'd looked up at the horses galloping past him at Sekigahara had his heart palpitated so. He sat cringing in the corner of the room.
"Go away, please," he pleaded. "Go back to your own room. If you don't, I'll call Matahachi. I'll wake the whole house up."
Oko did not budge. She sat there in the dark, breathing heavily and staring at him with narrowed eyes. She wasn't about to be rebuffed.
"Takezo," she cooed again. "Don't you understand how I feel?"
He made no reply.
"Don't you?"
"Yes. But do you understand how I feel, being snuck up on in my sleep, frightened to death and mauled by a tiger in the dark?" It was her turn to be silent. A low whisper, almost a growl, emerged from a deep part of her throat. She said each syllable with a vengeance.
"How can you embarrass me so?"
"I embarrass you?"
"Yes. This is mortifying."
They were both so tense, they hadn't noticed the knocking at the door, which had apparently been going on for some time. Now the pounding was punctuated by shouts.
"What's going on in there? Are you deaf? Open the door!"
A light appeared in the crack between the sliding rain shutters. Akemi was already awake. Then Matahachi's footsteps thudded toward them, and his voice called,
"What's going on?"
From the hallway now, Akemi cried out in alarm,
"Mother, are you in there? Please, answer me!"
Blindly, Oko scrambled back into her own room, just adjoining Takezo's, and answered from there. The men outside appeared to have pried open the shutters and stormed into the house. When she reached the hearth room, she saw six or seven pairs of broad shoulders crowded into the adjacent, dirt-floored kitchen, which was a big step down since it was set at a lower level than the other rooms. One of the men shouted,
"It's Tsujikaze Tenma! Give us some light!"
The men barged rudely into the main part of the house. They didn't even stop to remove their sandals, a sure sign of habitual uncouthness. They began poking around everywhere, in the closets, in the drawers, under the thick straw tatami covering the floor. Temma seated himself royally by the hearth and watched as his henchmen systematically ransacked the rooms. He thoroughly enjoyed being in charge, but soon seemed to tire of his own inactivity.
"This is taking too long,"
he growled, pounding his fist on the tatami.
"You must have some of it here. Where is it?"
"I don't know what you are talking about," replied Oko, folding her hands over her stomach forbearingly.
"Don't give me that, woman," he bellowed. "Where is it? I know it's here."
"I don't have a thing."
"Nothing?"
"Nothing."
"Well, then, maybe you don't. Maybe I have the wrong information."
He eyed her warily, tugging and scratching at his beard.
"That's enough, men," he thundered.
Oko had meanwhile sat down in the next room with the sliding door wide open. She had her back to him, but even so she looked defiant, as though telling him he could go ahead and search wherever he had a mind to.
"Oko," he called gruffly.
"What do you want?"
came the icy reply.
"How about a little something to drink?"
"Would you like some water?"
"Don't push me," he warned menacingly.
"The sake's in there. Drink it if you want to."
"Ah, Oko,"
he said, softening, almost admiring her for her cold-hearted stubbornness.
"Don't be that way. I haven't been to visit for a long time. Is this any way to treat an old friend?"
"Some visit."
"Now take it easy. You're partly to blame, you know. I've been hearing about what the Moxa man's widow has been up to from too many different people to think it's all lies. I hear you've been sending your lovely daughter out to rob corpses. Now, why would she be doing a thing like that?"
"Show me your proof," she shrieked. "Where's the proof?"
"If I'd been planning to dig it out, I wouldn't have given Akemi advance warning. You know the rules of the game. It's my territory, and I've got to go through the motions of searching your house. Otherwise, everybody'd get the idea they could get away with the same thing. Then where'd I be? I've got to protect myself, you know?"
She stared at him in steely silence, her head half turned toward him, chin and nose proudly raised.
"Well, I'm going to let you off this time. But just remember, I'm being especially nice to you."
"Nice to me? Who? You? That's a laugh."
"Oko," he coaxed. "Come here. Pour me a drink."
When she showed no sign of moving, he exploded.
"You crazy bitch! Can't you see that if you were nice to me, you wouldn't have to live like this?"
He calmed down a bit, then advised her.
"Think it over for a while."
"I'm overcome by your kindness, sir," came the venomous reply.
"You don't like me?"
"Just answer me this. Who killed my husband? I suppose you expect me to believe that you don't know?"
"If you want to take revenge on whoever it was, I'll be happy to help any way I can."
"Don't play dumb."
"What do you mean by that?"
"You seem to hear so much from people. Haven't they told you that it was you yourself who killed him? Haven't you heard that Tsujikaze Tenma was the murderer? Everyone else knows it. I may be the widow of a freebooter, but I haven't sunk so low that I'd play around with my husband's killer."
"You had to go and say it, didn't you? Couldn't leave well enough alone, eh?"
With a rueful laugh, he drained the sake cup in one gulp and poured another.
"You know, you really shouldn't say things like that. It's not good for your health. Or your pretty daughter's."
"I'll bring Akemi up properly, and after she's married, I'll get back at you. Mark my word."
Tenma laughed until his shoulders, his whole body, shook like a cake of bean curd. After he'd downed all the sake he could find, he motioned to one of his men, who was positioned in a corner of the kitchen, his lance propped vertically against his shoulder.
"You there," he boomed. "Push aside some of the ceiling boards with the butt of your lance."
The man did as he was told. As he went around the room, poking at the ceiling, Oko's treasure trove began falling to the floor like hailstones.
"Just as I suspected all along," said Tenma, getting clumsily to his feet. "You see it, men? Evidence. She's broken the rules, no question about it. Take her outside and give her her punishment."
The men converged on the hearth room, but abruptly came to a halt. Oko stood statuesquely in the doorway, as though daring them to lay a hand on her. Tenma, who'd stepped down into the kitchen, called back impatiently.
"What are you waiting for? Bring her out here!"
Nothing happened. Oko continued to stare the men down, and they remained as if paralyzed. Tenma decided to take over. Clicking his tongue, he made for Oko, but he too stopped short in front of the doorway. Standing behind Oko, not visible from the kitchen, were two fierce-looking young men. Takezo was holding the wooden sword low, poised to fracture the shins of the first comer and anyone else stupid enough to follow. On the other side was Matahachi, holding a sword high in the air, ready to bring it down on the first neck that ventured through the doorway. Akemi was nowhere to be seen.
"So that's how it is,"
groaned Tenma, suddenly remembering the scene on the mountainside.
"I saw that one walking the other day with Akemi, the one with the stick. Who's the other one?"
Neither Matahachi nor Takezo said a word, making it clear that they intended to answer with their weapons. The tension mounted.
"There aren't supposed to be any men in this house," roared Tenma. "You two, you must be from Sekigahara. You better watch your step. I'm warning you."
Neither of them moved a muscle.
"There isn't anybody in these parts who doesn't know the name of Tsujikaze Tenma. I'll show you what we do to stragglers."
Silence. Tenma waved his men out of the way. One of them backed straight into the hearth in the middle of the floor. He let out a yelp and fell in, sending a shower of sparks from the burning kindling up to the ceiling. In seconds, the room filled completely with smoke.
"Arr!"
As Tenma lunged into the room, Matachi brought down his sword with both hands, but the older man was too fast for him, and the blow glanced off the tip of Tenma's scabbard. Oko had taken refuge in the nearest corner while Takezo waited, his black oak sword horizontally poised. He aimed at Tenma's legs and swung with all his strength. The staff whizzed through the darkness, but there was no thud of impact. Somehow, this bull of a man had jumped up just in time, and on the way down threw himself at Takezo with the force of a boulder. Takezo felt as though he were tangling with a bear. This was the strongest man he had ever fought. Tenma grabbed him by the throat and landed two or three blows that made him think his skull would crack. Then Takezo got his second wind and sent Tenma flying through the air. He landed against the wall, rocking the house and everything in it. As Takezo raised the wooden sword to come down on Tenma's head, the freebooter rolled over, jumped to his feet, and fled, with Takezo close on his tail. Takezo was determined to not let Tenma escape. That would be dangerous. His mind was made up. When he caught him, he was not going to do a halfway job of killing him. He would make absolutely certain that not a breath of life was left. That was Takezo's nature. He was a creature of extremes. Even when he was a small child, there had been something primitive in his blood, something harking back to the fierce warriors of ancient Japan, something, as wild as it was, pure. It knew neither the light of civilization nor the tempering of knowledge, nor did it know moderation. It was a natural trait, and the one that had always prevented his father from liking the boy. Munisai had tried, in the fashion typical of the military class, to curb his son's ferocity by punishing him severely and often, but the effect of such discipline had been to make the boy wilder, like a wild boar whose true ferocity emerges when it is deprived of food. The more the villagers despised the young roughneck, the more he lorded it over them. As the child of nature became a man, he grew bored with swaggering about the village as though he owned it. It was too easy to intimidate the timid villagers. He began to dream of bigger things. Sekigahara had given him his first lesson in what the world was really like. His youthful illusions were shattered. Not that he'd really had many to begin with. It would never have occurred to him to brood over having failed in his first real venture, or to muse on the grimness of the future. He didn't yet know the meaning of self-discipline, and he'd taken the whole bloody catastrophe in stride. And now, fortuitously, he'd stumbled onto a really big fish. Tsujikaze Tenma, the leader of the freebooters. This was the kind of adversary he had longed to lock horns with at Sekigahara.
"Coward!" he yelled. "Stand and fight!"
Takezo was running like lightning through the pitch-black field, shouting taunts all the while. 10 paces ahead, Tenma was fleeing as if on wings. Takezo's hair was literally on end, and the wind made a groaning noise as it swept past his ears. He was happy, happier than he'd ever been in his life. The more he ran, the closer he came to sheer animal ecstasy. He leapt at Tenma's back. Blood spurted out at the end of the wooden sword, and a blood-curdling scream pierced the silent night. The freebooter's hulking frame fell to the ground with a leaden thud and rolled over. The skull was smashed to bits, the eyes popped out of their sockets. After 2 or 3 more heavy blows to the body, broken ribs protruded from the skin. Takezo raised his arm, wiping rivers of sweat from his brow.
"Satisfied, Captain?"
he asked triumphantly. He started nonchalantly back toward the house. An observer new on the scene might have thought him out for an evening stroll with not a care in the world. He felt free, no remorse, knowing that if the other man had won, he himself would be lying there, dead and alone. Out of the darkness came Matahachi's voice.
"Takezo, is that you?"
"Yeah,"
he replied dully.
"What's up?"
Matahachi ran up to him and announced breathlessly,
"I killed one. How about you?"
"I killed one too."
Matahachi held up his sword, soaked in blood right down to the braiding on the hilt. Squaring his shoulders with pride, he said,
"The others ran away. These thieving bastards aren't much as fighters. No guts. Can only stand up to corpses. Ha! Real even match, I'd say. Ha ha ha!"
Both of them were stained with gore and as contented as a pair of well-fed kittens. Chattering happily, they headed for the lamp visible in the distance. Takezo with his bloody stick, Matahachi with his bloody sword. A stray horse stuck his head through the window and looked around the house. His snorting woke the 2 sleepers. Cursing the animal, Takezo gave him a smart slap on the nose. Matahachi stretched, yawned, and remarked on how well he'd slept.
"The sun's pretty high already," said Takezo.
"You suppose it's afternoon?"
"Couldn't be."
After a sound sleep, the events of the night before were all but forgotten. For these 2, only today and tomorrow existed. Takezo ran out behind the house and stripped to the waist. Crouching down beside the clean, cool mountain stream, he splashed water on his face, doused his hair, and washed his chest and back. Looking up, he inhaled deeply several times, as though trying to drink in the sunlight and all the air in the sky. Matahachi went sleepily into the hearth room, where he bid a cheery good morning to Oko and Akemi.
"Why, what are you 2 charming ladies wearing sour pusses for?"
"Are we?"
"Yes, most definitely. You look like you're both in mourning. What's there to be gloomy about? We killed your husband's murderer and gave his henchmen a beating they won't soon forget."
Matahachi's dismay was not hard to fathom. He thought the widow and her daughter would be overjoyed at news of Tenma's death. Indeed, the night before, Akemi had clapped her hands with glee when she first heard about it. But Oko had looked uneasy from the first, and today, Slouching dejectedly by the fire, she looked even worse.
"What's the matter with you?"
he asked, thinking she was the most difficult woman in the world to please.
"What gratitude!"
he said to himself, taking the bitter tea that Akemi had poured for him and squatting down on his haunches. Okoo smiled wanly, envying the young, who know not the ways of the world.
"Matahachi," she said wearily, "you don't seem to understand. Tenma had hundreds of followers."
"Of course he did. Crooks like him always do. We're not afraid of the kind of people who follow the likes of him. If we could kill him, why should we be afraid of his underlings? If they try to get at us, Takezo and I will just..."
"We'll just do nothing," interrupted Okoo.
Matachi pulled back his shoulders and said,
"Who says so? Bring on as many of them as you like. They're nothing but a bunch of worms. Or do you think Takezo and I are cowards, that we're just going to slither away on our bellies and retreat? What do you take us for?"
"You're not cowards, but you are childish, even to me. Tenma has a younger brother named Tsujikaze Kohei, and if he comes after you, the two of you rolled into one wouldn't have a chance."
This was not the kind of talk Matahachi especially liked to hear, but as she went on, he started thinking that maybe she had a point. Tsujikaze Kohei apparently had a large band of followers around Yasugawa in Kiso, and not only that, he was expert in the martial arts and unusually adept at catching people off their guard. So far, no one Kohei had publicly announced he would kill had lived out his normal life. To Matachi's way of thinking, it was one thing if a person attacked you in the open. It was quite another thing if he snuck up on you when you were fast asleep.
"That's a weak point with me," he admitted. "I sleep like a log."
As he sat holding his jaw and thinking, Okoo came to the conclusion that there was nothing to do but abandon the house and their present way of life and go somewhere far away. She asked Matahachi what he and Takezo would do.
"I'll talk it over with him," replied Matahachi. "Wonder where he's gone off to."
He walked outside and looked around, but Takezo was nowhere in sight. After a time, he shaded his eyes, looked off into the distance, and spotted Takezo riding around in the foothills, bareback on the stray horse that had woken them with his neighing.
"He doesn't have a care in the world," Matachi said to himself, gruffly envious.
Cupping his hands around his mouth, he shouted,
"Hey, you! Come home! We've got to talk!"
A little while later, they lay in the grass together, chewing on stalks of grass, discussing what they should do next.
Matachi said, "Then you think we should head home?"
"Yes, I do. We can't stay with these two women forever."
"No, I guess not."
"I don't like women." Takezo was sure of that, at least.
"All right, let's go then."
Matachi rolled over and looked up at the sky.
"Now that we've made up our minds, I want to get moving. I suddenly realized how much I miss Otsu, how much I want to see her. Look up there. There's a cloud that looks just like her profile. See? That part's just like her hair after she's washed it."
Matachi was kicking his heels into the ground and pointing to the sky. Takezo's eyes followed the retreating form of the horse he had just set free. Like many of the vagabonds who live in the fields, stray horses seemed to him to be good-natured things. When you're through with them, they ask for nothing. They just go off quietly somewhere by themselves. From the house, Akemi summoned them to dinner. They stood up.
"Race you!" cried Takezo. "You're on!" countered Matachi.
Akemi clapped her hands with delight as the two of them sped neck and neck through the tall grass, leaving a thick trail of dust in their wake. After dinner, Akemi grew pensive. She had just learned that the two men had decided to go back to their homes. It had been fun having them in the house, and she wanted it to go on forever.
"You silly thing," chided her mother. "Why are you moping so?"
Okoo was applying her makeup, as meticulously as ever, and as she scolded the girl, she stared into her mirror at Takezo. He caught her gaze and suddenly recalled the pungent fragrance of her hair the night she invaded his room. Matahachi, who had taken the big sake jar down from a shelf, plopped down next to Takezo and began filling a small warming bottle, just as though he were master of the house. Since this was to be their last night altogether, they planned to drink their fill. Oko seemed to be taking special care with her face. "Let's not leave a drop undrunk," she said. "There's no point in leaving it here for the rats."
"Or the worms," Matachi chimed in.
They emptied three large jars in no time. Oko leaned against Matachi and started fondling him in a way that made Takezo turn his head in embarrassment.
I can't walk," mumbled Oko drunkenly.
Matachi escorted her to her pallet, her head leaning heavily on his shoulder. Once there, she turned to Takezo and said spitefully,
"You, Takezo, you sleep over there, by yourself. You like sleeping by yourself, isn't that right?"
Without a murmur, he laid down where he was. He was very drunk, and it was very late. By the time he woke up, it was broad daylight. The moment he opened his eyes, he sensed it. Something told him the house was empty. The things Oko and Akemi had piled together the day before for the trip were gone. There were no clothes, no sandals, and no Matahachi. He called out, but there was no reply, nor did he expect one. A vacant house has an aura all its own. There was no one in the yard, no one behind the house, no one in the woodshed. The only trace of his companions was a bright red comb lying beside the open mouth of the water pipe.
"Matahachi's a pig," he said to himself.
Sniffing the comb, he again recalled how Oko had tried to seduce him that evening not long ago. "This," he thought, "is what defeated Matahachi." The very idea made him boil with anger.
"Fool!" he cried out loud. "What about Otsu? What do you plan to do about her? Hasn't she been deserted too many times already, you pig?"
He stamped the cheap comb under his foot. He wanted to cry in rage, not for himself, but out of pity for Otsu, whom he could picture so clearly waiting back in the village. As he sat disconsolately in the kitchen, the stray horse looked in the doorway impassively. Finding that Takezo would not pat his nose, he wandered over to the sink and began lazily to lick some grains of rice that had stuck there. The Flower Festival. In the 17th century, the Mimasaka High Road was something of a major thoroughfare. It led up from Tatsuno in Harima Province, winding through a terrain proverbially described as one mountain after another. Like the stakes marking the Mimasaka-Harima boundary, it followed a seemingly endless series of ridges. Travelers emerging from Nakayama Pass looked down into the valley of the Aida River, where, often to their surprise, they saw a sizable village. Actually, Miyamoto was more a scattering of hamlets than a real village. One cluster of houses lay along the riverbanks, another huddled farther up in the hills, and a third sat amid level fields that were stony and hence hard to plow. All in all, the number of houses was substantial for a rural settlement of the time. Until about a year before, Lord Shinmen of Iga had maintained a castle not a mile up the river, a small castle as castles go, but one that nonetheless attracted a steady stream of artisans and tradespeople. Farther to the north were the Shikozaka silver mines, which were now past their prime but had once lured miners from far and wide. Travelers going from Tottori to Himeji or from Tajima through the mountains to Bizen naturally used the high road. Just as naturally, they stopped over in Miyamoto. It had the exotic air of a village often visited by the natives of several provinces and boasted of not only an inn, but a clothing store as well. It also harbored a bevy of women of the night who, throats powdered white, as was the fashion, hovered before their business establishments like white bats under the eaves. This was the town Takezo and Madahachi had left to go to war. Looking down on the rooftops of Miyamoto, Otsuu sat and daydreamed. She was a wisp of a girl, with fair complexion and shining black hair. Fine of bone, fragile of limb, she had an aesthetic, almost ethereal air. Unlike the robust and ruddy farm girls working in the rice paddies below, Otsu's movements were delicate. She walked gracefully, with her long neck stretched and head held high. Now, perched on the edge of Shippoji Temple porch, she was as poised as a porcelain statuette. A foundling raised in this mountain temple, she had acquired a lovely aloofness rarely found in a girl of 16. Her isolation from other girls her age and from the workaday world had given her eyes a contemplative, serious cast, which tended to put off men used to frivolous females. Matahachi, her betrothed, was just a year older, and since he'd left Miyamoto with Takezo the previous summer, she'd heard nothing. Even into the first and second months of the new year, she'd yearned for word of him, but now the fourth month was at hand. She no longer dared hope. Lazily, her gaze drifted up to the clouds, and a thought slowly emerged. Soon, it will have been a whole year. Takezo's sister hasn't heard from him either. I'd be a fool to think either of them is still alive. Now and then she'd say this to someone, longing, almost pleading with her voice and eyes, for the other person to contradict her, to tell her not to give up. But no one heeded her sighs. To the down-to-earth villagers who had already gotten used to the Tokugawa troops occupying the modest Shinmen castle, there was no reason in the world to assume they'd survived. Not a single member of Lord Shinmen's family had come back from Sekigahara, but that was only natural. They were samurai. They had lost. They wouldn't want to show their faces among the people who knew them. But common foot soldiers? Wasn't it all right for them to come home? Wouldn't they have done so long ago if they had survived? Why? Wondered Otsu, as she had wondered countless times before. Why do men run off to war? She had come to enjoy in a melancholy way sitting alone on the temple porch and pondering this imponderable. Lost in wistful reverie, she could have lingered there for hours. Suddenly, a male voice calling, "Otsu!" invaded her island of peace. Looking up, Otsu saw a youngish man coming toward her from the well. He was clad in only a loincloth, which barely served its purpose, and his weathered skin glowed like the dull gold of an old Buddhist statue. It was the Zen monk who, 3 or 4 years before, had wandered in from Tajima province. He'd been staying at the temple ever since.
"At last it's spring," he was saying to himself with satisfaction. "Spring, a blessing but a mixed one. As soon as it gets a little warm, those insidious lice overrun the country. They're trying to take it over, just like Fujiwara no Michinaga. That wily rascal of a regent."
After a pause, he went on with his monologue.
"I've just washed my clothes, but where on earth am I going to dry this tattered old robe? I can't hang it on the plum tree. It'd be a sacrilege, an insult to nature to cover those flowers. Here I am, a man of taste, and I can't find a place to hang this robe. Otsu, lend me a drying pole."
Blushing at the sight of the scantily clad monk, she cried, "Takuan, you can't just walk around half-naked till your clothes dry."
"Then I'll go to sleep. How's that?"
"Oh, you're impossible."
Raising one arm skyward and pointing the other toward the ground, he assumed the pose of the tiny Buddha statues that worshippers anointed once a year with special tea.
"Actually, I should have just waited till tomorrow. Since it's the 8th, the Buddha's birthday,
I could have just stood like this and let the people bow to me. When they ladled the sweet tea over me, I could have shocked everyone by licking my lips.
Looking pious, he intoned the first words of the Buddha.
In heaven above and earth below, only I am holy.
Otsu burst out laughing at his irreverent display.
You do look just like him, you know. Of course I do. I am the living incarnation of Prince Siddhartha.
Then stand perfectly still. Don't move. I'll go and get some tea to pour over you. At this point, a bee began a full-scale assault on the monk's head, and his reincarnation pose instantly gave way to a flailing of arms. The bee, noticing a gap in his loosely hung loincloth, darted in, and Otsu doubled up with laughter. Since the arrival of Takuan Soho, which was the name he was given on becoming a priest, even the reticent Otsu went few days without being amused by something he'd do or say. Suddenly, however, she stopped laughing.
I can't waste any more time like this. I have important things to do.
As she was slipping her small white feet into her sandals, the monk asked innocently,
What things?
What things? Have you forgotten too? Your little pantomime just reminded me. I'm supposed to get everything ready for tomorrow. The old priest asked me to pick flowers so we can decorate the flower temple. Then I have to set everything up for the anointing ceremony. And tonight I've got to make the sweet tea.
Where are you going flower picking?
Down by the river, in the lower part of the field.
I'll come with you.
Without any clothes on?
You'll never be able to cut enough flowers by yourself. You need help. Besides, man is born unclothed. Nakedness is his natural state.
That may be, but I don't find it natural. Really, I'd rather go alone.
Hoping to elude him, Otsu hurried around to the rear of the temple. She strapped a basket on her back, picked up a sickle and slipped out the side gate, but only moments later turned to see him close behind her. Takuan was now swathed in a large wrapping cloth, the kind people used to carry their bedding.
Is this more to your liking? He called with a grin.
Of course not. You look ridiculous. People will think you're crazy.
Why?
Never mind. Just don't walk next to me.
You never seemed to mind walking beside a man before.
Takuan, you're perfectly horrible.
She ran off ahead, with him following in strides that would have befitted the Buddha descending from the Himalayas. His wrapping cloth flapped wildly in the breeze.
Don't be angry, Otsu. You know I'm teasing. Besides, your boyfriends won't like you if you pout too much.
800 or 900 yards down from the temple, spring flowers were blooming profusely along both banks of the Ida River. Otsu put her basket down and, amid a sea of fluttering butterflies, began swinging her sickle in wide circles, cutting the flowers off near their roots. After a while, Takuan grew reflective.
How peaceful it is here,
he sighed, sounding both religious and childlike.
Why, when we could live out our lives in a flower-filled paradise, do we all prefer to weep, suffer, and get lost in a maelstrom of passion and fury, torturing ourselves in the flames of hell? I hope that you, at least, won't have to go through all that.
Otsu, rhythmically filling her basket with yellow rape blossoms, spring chrysanthemums, daisies, poppies, and violets, replied,
Takuan, instead of preaching a sermon, you'd better watch out for the bees.
He nodded his head, sighing in despair.
I'm not talking about bees, Otsu. I simply want to pass on to you the Buddha's teaching on the fate of women.
This woman's fate is none of your business.
Oh, but you're wrong. It's my duty as a priest to pry into people's lives. I agree it's a meddlesome trade, but it's no more useless than the business of a merchant, clothier, carpenter, or samurai. It exists because it is needed.
Otsu softened.
I suppose you're right.
It does happen, of course, that the priesthood has been on bad terms with womankind for some 3,000 years. You see,
Buddhism teaches that women are evil. Fiends. Messengers of hell. I've spent years immersed in the scriptures, so it's no accident that you and I fight all the time.
And why, according to your scriptures, are women evil?
Because they deceive men.
Don't men deceive women too?
Yes, but the Buddha himself was a man.
Are you saying that if he'd been a woman, things would be the other way around?
Of course not. How could a demon ever become a Buddha?
Takuan, that doesn't make any sense.
If religious teachings were just common sense, we wouldn't need prophets to pass them on to us.
There you go again, twisting everything to your own advantage.
That typical female comment.
Why attack me personally?
She stopped swinging her sickle again, a world-weary look on her face.
Takua, let's stop it. I'm not in the mood for this today.
Silence, woman!
You're the one who's been doing all the talking.
Takuan closed his eyes as if to summon patience.
Let me try to explain. When the Buddha was young, he sat under the Bo tree, where she demons tempted him night and day. Naturally, he didn't form a high opinion of women. But even so, being all merciful, he took some female disciples in his old age.
Because he'd grown wise or senile?
Don't be blasphemous, he warned sharply. And don't forget the Bodhisattva Nagarjuna, who feared women as much as the Buddha did. Even he went so far as to praise four female types, obedient sisters, loving companions, good mothers, and submissive maidservants. He extolled their virtues again and again and advised men to take such women as wives.
Obedient sisters, loving companions, good mothers, and submissive maidservants. I see you have it all worked out to men's advantage.
Well, that's natural enough, isn't it? In ancient India, men were honored more and women less than in Japan. Anyway, I'd like you to hear the advice Nagarjuna gave women.
What advice?
He said, "Woman, marry thyself not to a man."
That's ridiculous.
Let me finish. He said, "Woman, marry thyself to the truth."
Otsu looked at him blankly.
"Don't you see?" he said with a wave of his arm. "Marry thyself to the truth means that you shouldn't become infatuated with a mere mortal, but should seek the eternal."
"But Takuan," Otsu asked impatiently, "what is the truth?"
Takuan let both arms fall to his sides and looked at the ground.
"Come to think of it," he said thoughtfully, "I'm not really sure myself."
Otsu burst out laughing, but Takuan ignored her.
"There is something I know for certain. Applied to your life, wedding honesty means that you shouldn't think of going off to the city and giving birth to weak, namby-pamby children. You should stay in the country, where you belong, and raise a fine, healthy brood instead."
Otsu raised her sickle impatiently.
"Takuan!"
she snapped, exasperated.
"Did you come out here to help me pick flowers or not?"
"Of course I did. That's why I'm here."
"In that case, stop preaching and grab this sickle."
"All right. If you don't really want my spiritual guidance, I won't impose it on you," he said, pretending hurt.
"While you're busy at work, I'll run over to Ogin's house and see if she's finished the obi I'm supposed to wear tomorrow."
"Ogin? Takezo's sister? I've met her, haven't I? Didn't she come with you once to the temple?"
He dropped the sickle.
"I'll come with you."
"In that outfit?"
He pretended not to hear.
"She'll probably offer us some tea. I'm dying of thirst."
Totally spent from arguing with the monk, Otsu gave a weak nod, and together they set out along the riverbank. Ogin was a woman of 25, no longer considered in the bloom of youth, but by no means bad-looking. Although suitors tended to be put off by her brother's reputation, she suffered no lack of proposals. Her poise and good breeding were immediately evident to everyone.
She turned down all offers thus far simply on the grounds that she wanted to look after her younger brother a bit longer. The house she lived in had been built by their father, Munisai, when he was in charge of military training for the Shinmen clan. As a reward for his excellent service, he'd been honored with the privilege of taking the Shinmen name. Overlooking the river, the house was surrounded by a high dirt wall set on a stone foundation and was much too large for the needs of an ordinary country samurai. Although once imposing, it had become run down. Wild irises were sprouting from the roof, and the wall of the dojo, where Munisai once taught martial arts, was completely plastered with white swallow droppings. Munisai had fallen from favor, lost his status, and died a poor man, not an uncommon occurrence in an age of turmoil. Soon after his death, his servants had left, but since they were all natives of Miyamoto, many still dropped in. When they did, they would leave fresh vegetables, clean the unused rooms, fill the water jars, sweep the path, and in countless other ways help keep the old house going. They would also have a pleasant chat with Munisai's daughter. When Ogin, who was sewing in an inner room, heard the back door open, she naturally assumed it was one of these former servants. Lost in her work, she gave a jump when Otsu greeted her.
"Oh," she said, "it's you. You gave me a fright. I'm just finishing your obi now. You need it for the ceremony tomorrow, don't you?" "Yes, I do, Ogin. I want to thank you for going to so much trouble. I should have sewn it myself, but there was so much to do at the temple, I never would have had time." "I'm glad to be of help. I have more time on my hands than is good for me. If I'm not busy, I start to brood." Otsu, raising her head, caught sight of the household altar. On it, in a small dish, was a flickering candle. By its dim light, she saw two dark inscriptions, carefully brush-painted. They were pasted on boards, an offering of water and flowers before them. "The departed spirit of Shinmen Takezo, aged 17. The departed spirit of Hongiden Matahachi, same age."
"Okay," Otsu said with alarm. "Have you gotten word they were killed?"
"Well, no. But what else can we think?" "I've accepted it. I'm sure they met their deaths at Sekigahara."
Otsu shook her head violently.
"Don't say that. It'll bring bad luck. They aren't dead. They aren't. I know they'll show up one of these days."
Ogin looked at her sewing.
"Do you dream about Matahachi?" she asked softly. "Yes, all the time. Why?"
"That proves he's dead. I dream of nothing but my brother."
"Ogin, don't say that."
Rushing over to the altar, Otsu tore the inscriptions from their boards.
"I'm getting rid of these things. They'll just invite the worst."
Tears streamed down her face as she blew out the candle. Not satisfied with that, she seized the flowers and the water bowl and rushed through the next room to the veranda, where she flung the flowers as far as she could and poured the water out over the edge. It landed right on the head of Takuang, who was squatting on the ground below.
"Aye, that's cold!"
he yelped, jumping up frantically, trying to dry his head with an end of the wrapping cloth.
"What are you doing? I came here for a cup of tea, not a bath."
Otsu laughed until fresh tears of mirth came.
"I'm sorry, Takuang. I really am. I didn't see you."
By way of apology, she brought him the tea he'd been waiting for. When she went back inside, Ogin, who was staring fixedly toward the veranda, asked,
"Who is that?"
"The itinerant monk who's staying at the temple. You know, the dirty one. You met him one day with me, remember? He was lying in the sun on his stomach with his head in his hands, staring at the ground. When we asked him what he was doing, he said his lice were having a wrestling match. He said he'd trained them to entertain him."
"Oh, him."
"Yes, him. His name's Takuan Soho."
"Kind of strange."
"That's putting it mildly."
"What's that thing he's wearing? It doesn't look like a priest's robe."
"It isn't. It's a wrapping cloth."
"A wrapping cloth? He is eccentric.
How old is he?
He says he's 31, but sometimes I feel like his older sister. He's so silly. One of the priests told me that despite his appearance, he's an excellent monk.
I suppose that's possible. You can't always judge people by their looks. Where's he from?
He was born in Tajima Province and started training for the priesthood when he was 10. Then he entered a temple of the Rinzai Zen sect about 4 years later. After he left, he became a follower of a scholar priest from the Daitokuji and traveled with him to Kyoto and Nara. Later on, he studied under Gudo of the Myoshinji, Ito of Sennang, and a whole string of other famous holy men. He spent an awful lot of time studying.
Maybe that's why there's something different about him.
Otsu continued her story.
He was made a resident priest at the Nansoji and was appointed abbot of the Daitokuji by imperial edict. I've never learned why from anyone, and he never talks about his past, but for some reason he ran away after only 3 days.
Ogin shook her head. Otsu went on.
They say famous generals like Hosokawa and noblemen like Karasumaru have tried again and again to persuade him to settle down. They even offered to build him a temple and donate money for its upkeep, but he's just not interested. He says he prefers to wander about the countryside like a beggar, with only his lice for friends. I think he's probably a little crazy.
Maybe from his viewpoint, we're the ones who are strange.
That's exactly what he says.
How long will he stay here?
There's no way of knowing. He has a habit of showing up one day and disappearing the next.
Standing up near the veranda, Takuan called.
I can hear everything you're saying.
Well, it's not as though we're saying anything bad,
Otsu replied cheerfully.
I don't care if you do, if you find it amusing, but you could at least give me some sweet cakes to go with my tea.
That's what I mean, said Otsu. He's like this all the time.
What do you mean I'm like this?
Takuan had a gleam in his eye.
What about you? You sit there looking as though you wouldn't hurt a fly, acting much more cruel and heartless than I ever would.
Oh, really? And how am I being cruel and heartless?
By leaving me out here helpless, with nothing but tea, while you sit around moaning about your lost lover. That's how.
The bells were ringing at the Daishoji and the Shippoji. They had started in a measured beat just after dawn and still rang forth now and then long past noon. In the morning, a constant procession flowed to the temples, girls in red obis, wives of tradesmen wearing more subdued tones, and here and there an old woman in a dark kimono leading her grandchildren by the hand. At the Shippoji, the small main hall was crowded with worshippers, but the young men among them seemed more interested in stealing a glimpse of Otsu than in taking part in the religious ceremony.
"She's here, all right," whispered one.
"Prettier than ever," added another.
Inside the hall stood a miniature temple. Its roof was thatched with lime leaves, and its columns were entwined with wild flowers. Inside this flower temple, as it was called, stood a 2-foot-high black statue of the Buddha, pointing one hand to heaven and the other to earth. The image was placed in a shallow clay basin, and the worshippers, as they passed, poured sweet tea over its head with a bamboo ladle. Takuan stood by with an extra supply of the holy balm, filling bamboo tubes for the worshippers to take home with them for good luck. As he poured, he solicited offerings.
"This temple is poor, so leave as much as you can, especially you rich folks. I know who you are. You're wearing those fine silks and embroidered obis. You have a lot of money. You must have a lot of troubles, too. If you leave 100 weight of cash for your tea, your worries will be 100 weight lighter."
On the other side of the flower temple, Otsu was seated at a black lacquered table. Her face glowed light pink, like the flowers all around her. Wearing her new obi and writing charms on pieces of 5-colored paper, she wielded her brush deftly, occasionally dipping it in a gold lacquered ink box to her right. She wrote,
swiftly and keenly, on this best of days, the 8th of the 4th month, bring judgment to bear on those insects that devour the crops. From time immemorial, it had been thought in these parts that hanging this practical-minded poem